For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to the Ortho Joe Show, a joint production of the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery and Ortho Evidence. In our world, orthopedic research is king, and current topics from our respective publications are analyzed weekly. Here is Mohit Bhandari from Ortho Evidence and Mark Swinkowski from the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery.
Well, good morning, Mo. I just received my Ortho
branded
Joe coffee cup.
I need
from,
one. I
from
need
Jason one. And the team, and Bev and the marketing team. So I trust you've got yours somewhere.
Well, you know what? If it's arrived, I will be looking very aggressively for it, but I haven't seen it quite yet. But I'll have it for me next week. Yeah,
it's really
love
nice.
Love it. Awesome.
So, cheers, and I hope your week is going well so far.
It has.
Yeah. So, as I'm inclined to do now and then, I looked at a recent version of our publication. Sometimes I don't really pay that much attention because the stuff that's being published now, I last saw a couple of months ago, and I really try to make it a regular practice to see what an issue looks like. So as I was doing that this week, this manuscript caught my eye, and it's another RCT on the management of distal radius fractures. And I think it makes common sense that the most common injuries have the most RCTs. And I believe we've published, probably a dozen RCTs on distal radius fracture management in the last 3 to 5 years. And they all tend to be really, really well done. This one, no exception. It's from Norway, a group of investigators, and they studied volar locking plate versus external fixation in 156 patients. And the conclusion is pretty much what we found over and over again, and I believe what you've published in Ortho Evidence, that open reduction internal fixation has quicker return to function. But if you look at the outcomes at 1 year, they're roughly the same. So the question is, since we seem to be focusing on this outcome, that quicker return of function with roughly the same results at a year, is it possible to have too many RCTs on a particular topic?
You know, that's a great question. So I would say that, you know, the work we've done on, let's say, hip fractures, before we jump into the distal radius, the hip fractures for what, 5 decades was called the unsolved fracture, despite countless thousands and thousands of papers that were focusing on the hip fracture. And we tended to go in circles. You know, there would be, you know, the ebb and flow, the pendulum would go from fixation to replacement, and then we see it coming back a little bit towards fixation again. You see the same thing in the proximal humerus, and by no means is the distal radius, I think, immune to that same issue. And it's a hard question to ask. So one thing that I would have said for this particular study, anytime I've seen a randomized trial that comes out, one thing that it would be nice to see, and I don't know if this particular group did it, but we have been trying to conduct meta-analyses at the time that we're writing or publishing up a trial. So it does two things. One, it says, okay, here's what we found, but here's what this, you know, here's the nugget that this applies to the totality of the evidence in a larger group. And there have been lots of trials and lots of observational studies on this topic. Now, if you look back a couple of years, and I did, and you look at, you know, other reviews, honestly, this particular study, and again, huge, you know, last thing you want to do is tell authors who spent many years that their trial hasn't had the impact they hoped it does, because it's a huge amount of work to do a trial. So huge congratulations to anyone who conducts a trial, in particular these authors who did it. But those answers that they found, in many ways, were just confirmed by, you know, were predicted by prior studies. In other words, if you look 2 years ago, the same narrative was out there, right? That there wasn't really a huge advantage in the longer term. So you're right. You can ask yourself, why conduct another trial if there isn't some novel approach or something that we're going to come out that is going to do something to either definitively confirm or definitively refute? And I think we tend to get caught up in the cycle of doing research sometimes and not thinking about, well, what would be the potential cost of doing the research that could have been spent elsewhere if we had focused on a, you know, slightly different angle. I'm not saying it's exactly happened in this one, but I'm just, that's the general issue I think we all face, and I face it all the time.
Sure. But as we discussed the last time we got together 2 weeks ago on large data and machine learning, et cetera, the more data that we have to inform those protocols, the better off the precision increases. Isn't that accurate?
Oh, absolutely. So, but the point is, if you, for example, if you take a study of 150 patients, that's relatively imprecise. I mean, in this particular case, you know, I mean, it's just going to be imprecise because you have a small number of patients. It would have been powerful to say, okay, well, there's been at least 1,000 patients prior that have been involved in a numerous comparative studies and randomized trials. Why don't we look at add our 156 to that? And that gets you the precision. So in other words, the authors who published the trial, let's say, don't necessarily do that, but someone should go back quickly and do that and say, okay, what do we learn from all this information? And has it made us, you know, has it given us new insights? My perception is, looking at the results, that these insights that we have now are probably not ones we didn't already know.
Yeah, well, I've got another question to ask you, and I know you've had this. Anybody that's been involved in, I suppose, promoting randomized trials gets the question. Well, that's not my results. You know, my results are better. And we've talked in the past on OrthoJoe about the expert impact. So how do we really dialogue with our colleagues who say that the surgeon is the majority of the outcome, and these results don't apply to me because my results are better? How do you respond to that at Mac when you get that answer? Although I suppose at Mac you get that a lot less frequently than other centers.
Oh, no, we get it all the time, but it happens all the time. And the truth of the matter is, you know, there is no right answer to way to respond, because generally speaking, you know, if you look historically at journal clubs, you know, where papers were reviewed, you'd have that statement all the time. They'd say, you know, discard that paper. And it would usually be, you know, one of the influencers in the room who just happens to know that technique. It's just, you know, there's a lot of nuances that weren't done. And you all know that I don't do it that way, kind of thing, right? And that would be the difference. Yeah. The truth is that person, he or she, is correct. I mean, the reality is that the trial takes the average across the whole group. Now, you remember one way that we challenged that assertion in one of the, you know, our hip fracture trials was, you know, well, what if we just had surgeons who believe in a particular approach and are expert in a particular approach do that procedure? And we had called that the expertise-based trial. Now, that in itself has some advantages, because then you're only doing the procedure you really believe in. So, you know, you're getting two groups doing what they strongly believe in. The downside of it, though, is it also challenges someone to say, well, if treatment A works, then you have to say to yourself, okay, the treatment may work, but am I equivalent to the surgeons I believe who did that treatment? And if I don't feel comfortable, then I'd have to get retrained. So it does have some of those nuances that are built into the expertise-based design. There is no right answer to how we sort this out, but I do think there are questions that are more amenable to the broad generalizable trial, more of what we might consider to be the bread and butter, larger procedures where hopefully there would be a general level of comfort and confidence that would be, you know, provided by most people practicing in that area, rather than the very focused, you know, comminuted fracture treatment, the acetabular fracture treatment, where it would be a bit harder to generalize, you know, across multiple centers, multiple sites.
Right. So stick with the common patterns and the common diagnoses, and
Correct.
Try to make it as broadly applicable as possible.
Right. So in this case, for example, distal radius fractures, totally reasonable to consider a multi-center trial. The only thing I would say is if you had to go, you just go a lot bigger, and you think about and you ask yourself, what does a future trial look like? You know, and maybe we can discuss that. But I mean, you know, is it more of the same? And that's the question we'd have to think about. And how would you get to something more novel, I guess, would be the real challenge of a bigger trial.
Right. But I'd like to stick with a distal radius here, because I've got some other questions and I guess angles to ask you to consider. So now we're seeing at the journal a lot of cost effectiveness submissions. I would say the number of submissions is probably doubling every 18 months or so. Lots of interest in cost effectiveness. And the distal radius, of course, is no exception. I was able to find fairly easily this study, which is out of Harvard, on the cost effectiveness of the various ways of managing a distal radius, and really nice, well done study. And the procedural costs in the methods were $7,638 for closed reduction and perk pinning, $10,170 for open reduction internal fixation with a volar plate, and $9,886 for external fixation. So not a huge difference. And then when you consider the impact on the cost-adjusted quality of life and other outcome measures, these authors conclude that there's really only a 5 to 10% difference in the frequency of probability that find open reduction internal fixation to be more cost-effective. So very interesting. And so my question for you, again, going back to what we discussed last time we were having a cup of coffee, is as we build these huge data sets on patient complications and functional outcomes, et cetera, how is that going to improve our ability to do these cost effectiveness trials?
Well, so first of all, I'll just make a general statement on what I think we've seen across a wide variety of common fractures, which is when you often have multiple surgeons around the world feeling comfortable with multiple different approaches, as we do in the proximal humerus and the distal radius particularly as well, chances are that when they're tested, you know, experimentally, we're not likely going to see big differences, right? Because usually if there's a big difference, that wave happens and, you know, we change practice. So
like reality, with total hip arthroplasty.
Yeah, right. And the reality is that, you know, there's lots of great ways to treat a distal radius fracture. In this case, these were the extra articular types, right? The A3 types, if I recall from the paper. Okay. Yeah. So in that particular group, you would say, okay, you know, there are other approaches, whether it's pins, whether it's an X-fix, whether it's actually even the non-bridging X-fix. I recall back in the day with Margaret McQueen saying, you know, you get range of motion. So there's multiple ways to be innovative with any of the techniques. And I guess the bigger question, it gets back to the principle, I think, of evidence-based practice has been it begins and ends with the patient. So interacting with an individual patient, you know, you have to be able to give them an informed decision. And I think the papers that publish in the JBJS just do just that. They give you an ability to give patients a really informed decision around at least what we know is the current state of the evidence. So on par, you know, either is going to work. And if a patient says, no, I'd like to just have some pins and, you know, here's the reason why. Okay. And you can have a discussion with them. Well, so be it. That's not a bad decision in the context of where they will be a year from now.
Right.
You know, a sports figure may have a slightly different approach. You know, they may want to get back very quickly and then they may have a slightly different approach to how they want to manage it. But that would be that, you know, how you'd use this information. But the large data sets, to your point, absolutely. I think what we are missing out on is the opportunity to collect, you know, and you've used this term real world before, you know, as much data as we can possibly get. But whether it's real world or whether it's coming from aggregated randomized trials, it's still information that we can use. And I think we should be building many more algorithms as we get more data to understand who's at risk, which patients do better with which type. So what we do know is the extra articulars, maybe there's no difference, but there's a whole variant of fracture types that we could be calculating involving. We can't do enough trials, Mark, as you know, to capture all that, right? So some of the nuance variability and the precision is going to come from very big data sets. And I do think it's important that we collect them. I don't know if you are aware of any large groups that are collecting distal radius data sets, but I know, you know, we've seen it in hip, we've seen it in the shoulder. I know it's happening. And I'm sure, you know, we've seen it all throughout sports and the ACL, for example, and knee injuries. Yeah. But that would be an area where you'd really want to collect data.
Right. I'm unaware of any groups too. And I would be willing to bet there are some though.
Yeah.
So I've got one last aspect of this fracture to discuss, and it might be worthwhile to address this at a future Ortho Joe session. But to me, where we really need to focus is on this sentinel event as being the shout out, hey, I've got poor bone quality. You need to, as the treating surgeon, initiate an investigation of my bone quality. You need to do laboratory testing on the basics, you know, the vitamin D, the checking parathyroid function, et cetera, et cetera. And we are failing miserably at this. We've been at this trying to raise the level of interest and consciousness in the field of orthopedic surgery for 15, 20 years through the AOA's Own the Bone program and efforts in Canada. Earl Bogosch has been a real leader. Yeah. And with the advent of fracture liaison services and things, but we've got a long way to go. And what really brought this as why bringing it up today is when I was seeing patients more frequently who had hip fractures, I had three in a row in one clinic session who, when I look back at the record, these were patients in their 70s. They all had a distal radius fracture in their 50s, and nobody did an investigation or did anything about it. And I don't know how we can construct a trial to further motivate our colleagues to pay attention to this as a sentinel event in investigating bone health. Do you have any thoughts on this? I know we're running out of time, but
yeah, sure. I mean, so first of all, I think, you know, it's more of a comment than anything, but I fully agree with what you're saying, because even in our trial data on hip fractures, for example, we found that even in a controlled trial environment where surgeons, you know, there's always a positive response bias and you're being watched, you're kind of, you know, you want to be your best. 15-20% of patients with hip fractures were getting a formal, put on the appropriate medications for osteoporosis, and realizing that in the patient populations we were dealing with, that was an osteoporotic marker right there. Yeah. Distal radius is the same thing. And I think it gets back to historical just ownership, right? There's perception is that this is a medical issue. And, you know, one, I'm not up on all the treatments, and I don't want to start, you know, getting involved in managing all these treatments. I'm not an expert. But then the other disconnect, I think, is, well, someone in the system for sure, like the patient's family physician, someone is going to manage this. And then what happens is everyone, you know, is looking at everybody else and it's not happening. Yeah, right. Right. And that's exactly it. And I just think that we are putting too much of the blame because we're not owning it. And I think, to your point, the exact term is own that bone. And if we at least do some simple things, we can make that difference. And I don't know what would change practice, considering the amount of energy that's gone into osteoporosis, and also among our rheumatologist colleagues and endocrinology colleagues in doing the research. The data is there. It's just, I think it's an issue, again, of knowledge dissemination. And to your point, owning it.
Taking responsibility.
Absolutely.
Well, it's been a great discussion. And next time we meet, it'll be your topic to choose.
I know.
Yeah. I just want to remind our listeners, we are developing that mailbag function. So I look for the information on how to make a comment or ask a question or perhaps introduce a topic that we can discuss in the future. So until then, Mo, cheers. Have a good day. Cheers. And hopefully your coffee will energize you to a great day.
I will. Well, and I'm looking for my cup. I'm going to go run out right now and see if I can find that thing. So okay. Hopefully for next time. Awesome. Yeah.
Thanks very much.
Take care. Bye.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.